Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
You may have heard local poet Philip Hemingway on The Writer's Room. He is my guest today. He taught English and French at Butte College for 31 years. Philip Hemingway was born in Gridley and raised in Oroville, where he finished high school, and then he enrolled at Chico State College. He earned a BA in French and English, and then an MA in English in what became California State University, Chico. Phil Hemingway has worked in the fruit orchards, stacked cans in a cannery, and taught English and ESL part-time. He has now published a collection of his poems, Core Samples. Philip Hemingway, welcome.
Thank you.
And just in case people think I'm mispronouncing your last name, it is H-E-M-E-N-W-A-Y.
That's right. No relation.
Well, you have so many varied settings for your poems. They take place in all sorts of different places. So it seemed to me that you've done a lot of traveling.
I have, yeah. I started before I was actually ready and had a rather abortive trip to Europe when I was 20 and came back and girded up my travel loins and tried it again. Had about 8 months in Europe. Traveling around, I bought a Fiat 500, 61, with a 500cc motor and drove it over the Alps. I had to go in first gear over the Alps. Yeah. And then in those days, you came to the end of the road and just drove onto a flat car, and the train took you through down to the other side. So, but yeah, I've been quite a few places in Vietnam and Mexico, Canada.
Well, now, since you mentioned France, you said that was the first time you went to France.
Yep.
But then you went back to France because you actually was a teacher there.
Yep. I taught there for a semester with a group of California college students. And it was a consortium of students from various schools. And we had a facility there, and it was pretty – it was – a little weird with a group of California students in France in January. They were standing around in their cutoffs and Hawaiian shirts skateboarding and trying to look cool. And
well, not many tourists go to Paris in the winter, and so they probably can't really appreciate what you're describing because it's short days,
cold.
Long,
yeah,
cold,
it
wet,
gets dark soon.
Rainy.
Yeah, they caught on after a while, and once one of the most difficult things for me while I was there was trying to get them to go places besides the Hard Rock Cafe and McDonald's, and because they were frightened.
Well, but the McDonald's in say France or Paris is
a little more cosmopolitan.
Yes, yeah. Yes,
yeah. And I took my English class. I had a freshman composition class, and I took them to this cafe that I knew, and we'd have class there periodically, and they'd drink espresso and pay a lot closer attention when we were there than when we were in the classroom. But I took another class out to dinner one night. They knew nothing about French food. There's no reason why they should. So I took them out to dinner in this place in Saint-Germain-des-Prés that I really liked, and the waiter got in the swing of things and was great, and we just had a blast. It was really fun. They were eating oysters for the first time and all sorts of I think one even tried escargot and the traditional, oh my God, it's French food stuff.
Well, once in France, I was trying to get to train, and I ran up to the guy in the uniform and blurted out my question before I said bonjour. Oh, my gosh. I got the coldest stare in reply.
Yeah.
So I'm sure one of the first words you taught your students was bonjour.
Bonjour, monsieur, madame, ouais. Mademoiselle. That's just part of the social formula. If you do that, you avoid some of the negative feelings that we associate as Americans with Parisians, and they associate with us for being loud Americans.
So if you took them to, say, a cafe, before they ordered that espresso, before they say, I'd like an espresso, they would say, bonjour.
Well, I told them that, but the first time I took them, I had to do the ordering. They were terrified.
My guest is Philip Hemingway, and he has a collection of poems called Core Samples. And a lot of them take place in, you mentioned, say, Indiana and Hoosiers. Mm-hmm. So I figure you've been there.
Oh, yeah. My sister lives there. And I went back to visit her one time. And I was on the train when we got word that the shuttle had exploded and Krista McAuliffe had died. And as a teacher myself, it was very touching. And part of the one whole section of the poem is of the book is about that train ride that, across country to Indiana.
Well, you also mentioned one of my favorite poets, and this is Pablo Neruda. And he has such a sense of humor, I think. He wrote a poem about socks.
Well, his collection, Odes Elementales, he has one about onions that I really like, you know, just, you know, hanging there in a sack in the kitchen, you know. And his passion, he could move his passion for socks to the woman he was currently enamored of. And so many of his poems have that Latin love of the passionate that, he just...
And to write a poem about something as ordinary as socks. You can't get much more ordinary than socks.
That's, and that was his... That was his thing. He could write about anything, it seemed like, because he had that almost childish joy at the commonplace, and at the same time, his emotions were seldom blocked by the sorts of things that adults experience when they're older and they're in love, you know.
Well, speaking of poets, the title of your book is inspired. You tell us on the back of your book who inspired the title of your book. Let me remind listeners that the title of your book is Core Samples. So you look at the cover, okay, Core Samples, poems by Philip Hemingway. But Core Samples? And the cover has a windmill, and I think...
Sounds like geology, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah. So tell us where you got the idea for the title, Core Samples.
Well, growing up around here and being interested in, we used to go out and, before it was against the law when we were kids, we'd go out and dig for arrowheads and things.
Oh, yeah, I did that when I was a kid.
Out, you know, on the buttes. And we found quite a deposit one day, and never went back. Being kids, you know, I think I was a sophomore in high school, and then the following summer, a team from Berkeley came up and excavated our cave, and went down a foot and found a complete burial. It was pretty amazing. And after that, you know, it's as it should be. It's against the law, but.
Well, I wasn't very successful. I went with my cousins. We looked out for arrowheads, and they would find them, I was too distracted.
Well, you know, and when they were building Oroville Dam, there was all kinds of studies, and the idea of a core sample, of being able to drill down and then read what comes out from the bottom to the surface of the earth, and, you know, the recent work with the glaciers doing the same thing, coring them and then looking, seeing what the weather was like in 1200 AD, you know, from a glacier. I like that idea, but the line is from a William Butler Yeats poem, Lake Isle of Industry, and his line is, I hear it in the deep heart's core. Is his last line in the poem, and it struck me as the heart has a core too if you bore it down, and so that's where I got the idea.
Well, when I'm reading your book, I went to Google so many times. That was one of the times. I want to know more about that poem by William Butler Yeats that inspired it. And so I Googled that that poem.
Uh-huh.
So why don't we, well, let me ask you how you arranged them, because you have such a variety of topic subjects. And so how did you sort out these poems that you wrote?
As I've grown on in years, I noticed that I tend to blurt, and I did one of the sections in there. I did sections in there. I did many years ago, and I did it in a weekend, just going nonstop. And when something gets me, I tend to stay with it. And then the general thematic approach is less important to me than what I was doing at any particular time. And so that's what I did. That last part, Gallimofri, was me just putting in some of my favorites because they didn't really fit in anywhere else.
Now, listeners might have missed that word that you just said, Gallimofri, because what a handy word.
Oh, it's a wonderful word. Yeah.
I'm surprised we don't use that word more often. Maybe you should define that word, Gallimofri.
Well, it's like the gallery that's never been properly curated. It's the catch-all room. It's generally associated with excess, with all the strangeness. You know, there is a clash between things you might see on one wall as opposed to the other, and that's.
So that was one of the times it sent me to Google, because this is the title of your sixth section in
yeah.
your collection,
right.
And so I thought, what an interesting word. So I spent time looking at all the shades of meaning of that word. But now your first section, you call it articles, and you start reading and you think, oh, his guns, his snapshots, his razor, his stick. You go on, everything is his except the very last poem. And listeners might wonder, well, who's the his? Who's these things, who are that belong to him?
The very last poem?
No, the others, all that begin with his uh-huh. hoe, his tires, his
yeah.
secret. Who is the he is, his?
My grandfather. Yeah. And after he died, my brother and I, Britt, were called upon to go through his stuff. And he had been a carpenter by trade, and he had lots of stuff, but it was grandpa's stuff.
Yeah.
There was something wrong with just about everything.
but
he just, it didn't bother him. He just used it. One of the things was he seemed somehow immune to electric shock. He all of his tools gave you a shock, but he was he only went to the third grade. You know, he was a child of the South Dakota Badlands, and so he came out here in a 1929 Studebaker Dictator with his wooden spoke wheels and with his family, and settled first in Biggs and then in Oroville and Thermalito.
My guest is local poet Philip Hemingway, and his book is Core Samples. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Philip Hemingway. The title of his collection of poems is Core Samples. And I think when people look at these titles, what you were just describing, so many of us are going to have to do what you were just describing that you did, whether it's a spouse or a parent, and in your case, a grandparent, that you have to go through their things. And it's just, it's emotional. I mean, just looking at this list, I got emotional just thinking of what you were going through.
Well, I was with my dad for some of it, and it was kind of rough for him. And he was at a loss, literally, but at the same time, he didn't know what to do. And he was there wasn't really much left, but he was the executor of it, and that was so he had that responsibility. So these things. When my parents split up, I lived with my grandparents for a while, quite a while, and so I developed a kind of intimacy with his stuff. I was warned away from it a lot of times. His tools, don't mess with his tools.
Yeah, I would imagine. Now, your next section is called a zoo journal, and I think it was the San Diego Zoo that mm-hmm. you went to. So yeah. Here's more of your traveling around.
Well, yeah, I was living in Ventura then, and some friends came down, and we went down to the San Diego Zoo to visit. It was wonderful, and these things sort of popped out after I got home.
Well, you have things like pilgrims, prairie dogs, and penguins. But some of these critters, of course, tigers and elephants, people know. But some of them, what is he writing about?
Which one is that?
Well, you have koolas, and you have a cassowary.
Cassowary, yeah. Cassowary is an amazing bird. And it has this amazing, like a single-bitted axe head. And it's really dangerous because it can swing that thing and slice you up pretty good, and it's kind of an ornery bird, and watching it run up and down the fence line in the zoo, and then being warned away, don't get too close because they can be bad. But I don't know, they were so ugly that they kind of appealed to me.
Well, right after penguins, then you have hummingbird house.
Yeah, we had an orchard for a while. We lived out in the orchard, we had hummingbirds. We had 4 or 5 feeders, and my wife has a picture of me standing with about 40 hummingbirds, a cluster around my head because they would be attracted to my glasses, and of course, I would be standing next to a feeder. So I've always been with a name like Hemingway. It wasn't long before in high school they were calling me things like Hemingbird Hummingway and all those things. So I've always been attracted to hummingbirds.
I'm sure in those days you didn't have a phone where you could take video, but now you could video the way those wings move. Yeah. It just amazes me. Those little birds are so fascinating.
Well, especially in the hummingbird house at the zoo, because you're surrounded by them, and it's just really cool. To watch them eat an orange or something, I love them.
My guest is Philip Hemingway. He's a local poet now. He spent his career as a teacher for 31 years. He taught English and French at Butte College, but now in his retirement become a poet. And his book is entitled Core Samples, referring to the heart's core. So the third section, you've arranged your poems in these groups. The first section, articles, his, guns. Second, a zoo journal. We were just talking about you visited the zoo, San Diego.
Right.
Then the third section is shuttle. And that's when you mentioned the birthday of Neruda, mm-hmm. One of my favorite poems. Right. And that, too, brings up the point that I don't think you can really translate poetry. You can translate words, but not, I think, poet, you need to read the poem in its original, just like French. If you read, I love French poets in their language they wrote it in.
Yeah.
But you were going to say about Neruda.
Well, there's the old Latin phrase that translates translator, traitor. It's difficult to do. And when you develop a love or a friendship with a language and you write, most of the time you're cautioned, to write in your language, don't drop in French or Italian or Spanish phrases, even if they're better and they say what you want to say in English better. And I mean, this is the reason that French was the language of diplomacy for centuries, mm-hmm. because you could be very precise in arenas where the wrong word could start a war.
And the title of the first poem, Under Shuttle, is July 12th, 1985. And the poem starts out on Neruda's birthday. So I think that might send people to Google saying, Neruda? Who was that?
Pablo Neruda, the great poet laureate who was, some say, murdered by Allende during the coup in Chile.
He was lived in Chile, by the way.
Yeah,
people
yeah,
don't know.
Yeah. And he was truly great. And he was a threat, therefore, to the regime, not necessarily because of his politics, but because of what his poetry represented.
Well, this section three, Shuttle, has divisions also, and you have seven divisions in that. The word meditation comes up nearly every section. You have the word meditation.
Well, the format for this was determined by that train ride that I took from Sacramento to Chicago, and then down to Mattoon, Illinois, to visit my sister, who was 20 miles away in Indiana. And on the train ride, stupidly, it was 48 hours, and I was pretty young, so I sat up the whole way, and I did a lot of meditating, half asleep, and so some of those things are things that occurred to me in that drift zone between sleep and full awake.
Now, you just used the word stupidly, but you were young. I mean, there's a lot of things we do that we see now as stupid, but we were young.
Well, yeah, and that was part of the attraction. I always liked the train. I loved taking the train in Europe. So when I did this, of course, American trains are nothing like that. But it was quite an experience. I was with all these people for 48 hours on the way to Chicago, and we talked, and then watching what was going on outside the train was pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah. So. Well, your next section is, the title of section four is Just a Visit. And you visited so many places, people think, oh, just a visit? Where?
Vietnam. My sister was working for a corporation that builds clubs for corporations, executives. And she was given as part of her contract, was given this incredible three-story house to live in, this French provincial knockoff. It was built, and with the local dignitary from the Communist Party, her landlord right next door, and who was a very nice man, had us over for dinner and everything. But I went. She said, you have to see this, and she was right, so I went. And it's one of the things that got me that when I was there was I had this sudden need to make it clear to people that this was my first visit. I hadn't been there before during the war. And one of the things I discovered was that most of the people I met had no idea who I was or where I was from. And the war for their parents and grandparents was something, but for the young people, not so much.
Well, there's a poem in this section called Train Ride, and you actually read this for the writer's room.
Right.
But when that section, people just read their poem. So I would like you to read your poem, Train Ride, and give you a chance to make any comments that you have to make
okay.
in your book. And I'm sure you remember. But this is on page 62.
Yeah. This was one of the things that you discover when you go to Asia, or I discovered anyway, is what differentiates East with a capital E from West with a capital W. And one of the things that, particularly in in a still communist country like Vietnam, which is authoritarian more than it is truly communist. But the people themselves live communally. But we went out to Haiphong, historically important because that was one of the reasons for one of the big attacks. We claimed that they might mine the harbor in Haiphong when in fact it was a lie. And so, but we went out there. Beautiful, it's a beautiful area on the coast, and those wonderful hills that grow out there around in the sea are it's just beautiful. It just looks like those Asian silk scrolls. With the huge depictions of it's just beautiful. So this particular thing happened on the ride back from Haiphong. We were going back to Hanoi. Train ride. On the rattling train from Haiphong to Hanoi, we stop amid wails and cries where a dirt track crosses the rails. People move in tight clusters to stare at a tangle of metal half under our hard seat car, now the means a young cyclist has used to call herself off, according to an ancient man explaining to his deaf wife in loud and imperial French the truth of our solemn delay. Soon, an official car responds, no ambulance of our Western expectation, and four soldiers haul the dead woman away, indifferent to her condition. Thus my wife sits weeping at what she cannot accept here. As the train jolts into motion, a child offers her sweets made of black banana paste and peas.
This is my guest, local poet Philip Hemingway, and he's reading from his book, Core Samples. Now, there's another poem on the facing page after the train ride, and I'd like for you to read the poem that you call Privacy in Lennon Park.
Okay. Lennon Park, of course, is the Central Park of Hanoi, and it is beautiful in that effusive tropical way. It is a public place, and any public place in Vietnam is truly public. Anybody can go there. And my wife and I went for a walk there one day in the 100-degree heat and 90% humidity and had a look at it, and it was pretty amazing. You could see the French overtones from when they were there, but it was really quite nice. And one of the things we noticed while we were in Vietnam is there's not a lot of privacy. The siesta in the afternoon, people just lay down on the sidewalk. We went to an airport one time, and there was nobody there, absolutely nobody. And then we were looking around, and they were all sleeping behind the counters for the various airlines. It was time for a nap. So anyway, this is what happened when we went to the park. It's called Privacy in Lennon Park. In a public place overhung with mutant plants and mysteries, our path winds to a copse of banana and mango trees among the harsh tangles of tropic greens and blacks, where the fetid lake surrenders to the incursions of algae. We notice the entwined couple rocking modestly face to face beneath the careful folds of her tunic, our 30 meters distance as good as any wall, and we speed up as her head lolls back and she faces the boiling turquoise sky. Then we see four or five men scattered in tight squats singly in the thigh-high grasses, enthralled by the tantric lotus slowly swaying in the shade, and they make our mindful haste a vain offering of a commodity here grown beyond merely rare.
Again, this is my guest, Phil Hemingway, reading from his book, a collection of poems, Core Samples. Now, nowhere in this poem do you tell us where you are located, other than, you say, privacy in Lenin Park.
It's Hanoi.
Well, I mean, you don't tell us that in the poem itself.
No.
Another reason that when people are reading your poems, they have to stop and think, well, I wonder where this is. Maybe I'll Google Lenin Park. But also people might wonder, well, if he's spending this time and thought on Vietnam, maybe he was a soldier during the Vietnam War. And you even say, a couple of pages after this, you say, I must claim my war, the one I did not choose to fight in. My name is absent from the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was actively against it, you know, did all the public and private ceremonies to, you know, a kid I knew from grammar school looked me up when it was getting dicey, and he and his family had moved to Canada, and he said, I got a place for you, you know, a grammar school friend. It was amazing. So I was lucky. I was in the first lottery, and they got within three of my number by December 31st, but I didn't. Well, so I was out.
My husband and I were in that generation, and we were looking to know, okay, are we going to Canada?
Yeah.
And then his draft board was in Florida, where they are kind of a shortage of young men. And so he said, you know, you paid my way to get a PhD, and now you want me to put a gun in my hand?
Mm-hmm.
Because they did. He had a fellowship, not an assistantship like I did.
Sure.
But, that generation, we were looking, okay, is it going to be Canada?
Well, one of the most idiotic, absurd dramas I ever experienced, and I was in it, was going for my pre-induction physical at the Oakland Army Center.
Yep.
It was just insane. And I'm looking at these people, and they want to give some of these guys guns. It was nuts.
Yeah.
And so, no.
Well, and the last poem in that section is called Vietnam Memorial. Now, the next section, Penetralia, and you have another word that people think, what? What is it? Sisters, what? And so you have a poem in this next section called Sisters Epithalamion.
Yep.
And that's that's a mouthful, Epithalamion. And what in the world does that mean?
It's a marriage celebration. the 17th and 18th century English poets wrote epithalamions periodically.
Well, I think you've piqued the listener's curiosity. Why don't you read us,
okay.
Sisters?
All right, this was
Epithalamion.
When my sister got married, I wrote this, Sisters Epithalamion. We live on a spinning planet of odd direction, kids. Somebody shows up, starts telling you how to embalm your toenails, braid those pesky nose hairs, market that belly button lint. Listen, you're getting married, and this is how it works. First, beauty is the prime directive. Look around you sharp and see there's nothing ugly here. And so the lesson may begin. Never say, is dinner ready? Whisper instead, there's a color found only in the fourth minute of a spring twilight in Rome. It reminds me of the moment your lasagna leaves the oven. Never say, no, it's your turn to do the laundry. Instead, leave a crumpled note that sighs, meet me in Paris tomorrow, room 16, Lord Byron Hotel. P.S., you'll need clean socks. Never say, we're broke, we can't. Money is the major tragedy without a hero. Birth to death and later, it sings of what you should have and can't until day after tomorrow. Be wise and brave. Learn to borrow. There you have some basic rules to keep passion in the contract. They can make the business something more than two yawns between stares. All of us here are fatally human. We must never rush out to prove it. Oh, yes, about those intimate moments for which love has long encoded a secret language of quick escape, as when, for instance, you must say, "Excuse us, dear friends. We must go home now and bathe our dirty poodle." I find this formula more than useful. When Eros calls, imagine yourselves astride the hood of a 59 Caddy doing 90 down a long dirt road in Nevada. You need no other advice at all except hold on tight till the machine stops.
And the title of this poem is Sisters Epithalamion, and it was written by Philip Hemingway, a Chico poet. The title of the collection is Core Samples. I want to go back to a couple of lines in that poem. All of us here are fatally human. We must never rush out to prove it.
Well, I guess what I was trying to warn them about was what happens when two people get married and emotions get entangled and we're capable of saying and doing things that normally we wouldn't do. And so I was some brotherly advice.
After a break, Philip Hemingway and I will continue our conversation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, local poet Philip Hemingway. His collection of poems is entitled Core Samples. Well, back in the day, we're still in this fifth grouping of your poems, Penetralia, and the title of the poem is Smoking.
Smoking, yeah.
Would you read us Smoking?
Sure. I loathe tobacco in all its forms, and I always have. I've never smoked, and I grew up in a world where everybody smoked.
I grew up where they grew tobacco. And of course, during World War II, smoke them if you got them.
Yep, exactly. And this was when I was in high school. That dilemma presented itself because that's when people started smoking and. I started high school in 1962, so it was. I watched smoking through the years kill a lot of people, relatives, people I cared about, and I can remember my great uncle Russell lighting a cigarette sitting on the steps of his trailer, and this was a man who had been gassed during World War I. It was. That, of course, that explained why he was always so ornery, but it was amazing. Anyway, so this is called Smoking. The habit kicked me at birth, Mom's Camels having colored my stay at the Hotel Amnion when I squirted into Tobacco World 1948 and lived in it, ashes flying in the smallest breeze, Sciroccos arcing into my eyes with a red tip flicked idly out one speeding car window, back into my world vision. Howls of pain brought the irate slaps and orders to sit back and it won't happen, then righteous inhalings and blue clouds swirling. Kitchen home permanent days, the stench of chemical beauty in Grandma's foggy Chesterfields. The whole world was my dragon, breathing fire, death, and mystery. Men got lucky with lucky strikes. And what did they mean when they said, mattress, smattress, don't forget the smokes? Joni Sliger smoked the night she drove me home in her Cadillac. The bad guys smoked, and the good guys did and lied about it. Smart people, dumb people, I don't know. Sometimes I hear the tumor growing deep in my mother's chest, hear it crackle beneath her little tattoo, the sight of the cobalt bombardment as it noses like a reptile through a cover of healthy tissues toward an artery it can eat. I don't know. Smart people, dumb people. We're all just waiting to go, but the phone rings, and I hear, "Oh, you're home. Just let me get a cigarette."
This is my guest, local poet Phil Hemingway, and he's reading from his collection, Core Samples, collection of poems. This one was Smoking, and it sounds, when you read this poem, it sounds like this was true, that your mother smoked?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, she had vowed never to grow old. She was a very vain woman, and she had other issues too, but she was determined to not to grow old. And she died at 68 from lung cancer, from the cancer that I mentioned here. And so it was purely intentional. That's what she wanted to do.
Because in my day, my dad smoked, but not a lot, but he smoked. But my mother did not smoke. Women didn't smoke as much as men did when I was growing up. Well, so that's why I'm saying your mother was kind of...
Well, she was...
Independent woman, would you say?
Well, in a way, but she was more taken by Hollywood. She named my sister for Lana Turner.
One of your poems has the name Lana in the name of the poem.
My sister.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. So you write this poem, Smoking, because your mother smoked. And then as we continue in your grouping, we come to that word that I love, gallimaufry. And in this grouping, you have a poem called Chaos Theory.
Yeah.
Chaos Theory, that could be a lot of things.
Well, Chaos Theory is the notion that it's a variation on the cause and effect, that there can be causes for which we'll never know the effects. And the classic example of it is the butterfly flapping in the Amazon River basins causing a hurricane around the world, somewhere around the world. And that may seem far-fetched, but it's a theory, right? It's chaos theory. And so I was talking with my friend one day about the story behind his blind eye. And he's my age, so through the years he'd contemplated this many times because it made a huge effect on his life, and because he got shot. And he reached the age where he was philosophically trying to determine whether this was somehow meant to be, and we both giggled at that.
But do you know that to me that poem was touching because I have a niece whose husband, talented athlete, he went to university on a scholarship, but he couldn't play ball because he lost the sight in one eye. Uh-huh. He could swim, fantastic swimmer, but and he blamed his dad. And when I was reading that, I said, "Oh my gosh, this guy loses the sight of his eye."
Yeah, well, but to use the trite expression, he landed on his feet because in a certain way, it released him from certain expectations in his life. So,
well, it changed this young man's course of his life instead of playing ball because he would have been good in just about any sport. But he excelled in swimming.
He became a
because he had lost sight in one
piano player.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Would you read that poem before
we
finish up?
Chaos Theory. This is his story. My one-eyed friend left half-blind at 14 when doves, the hunt jumped, rose up and shotguns swung to follow, and one dumb kid dropped him with a wild shot into his still innocent eye. Today he leans over the keys of his piano, an Ellington tune undulating from his easy moves, fingers at home with ivory. The cause and effect of music, a math he cultivates most days, touch, tone, stretch, chords, and the room swings with Duke. 62 years since that day, a determinant flew into his life of deer and bird hunts he feared, football practices he loathed. In his time and place, he faced the obstacles of blood expectations engendered by family ties and all those small-town codes. Then came the hospital days, the morphine for the needles buried in that ruined eye, and the fugue state of his pain. He healed to a new paradigm. The hunting accident survivor left blind in his right eye and no good for the interior line. Some days, he thinks that Amazon butterfly flapping leisurely in Brazil nudged a California shotgun muzzle just enough to force his recalibration, the bad eye, a sudden license, to find something else he might do. So he looked around from his singular vantage and saw a piano. It's for Jim.
This is my guest, Philip Hemingway. He's a local poet now. He taught English and French here in Chico for a long time. And there, that last thing you said, it was for Jim. And so this is another poem that I think is based on truth and reality.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, that one's very recent because it's taken him a long time to talk about it. And we've been talking about it. And so this just popped out one day. And so I gave it to him, and he appreciated it. So
I would think so. And I appreciate this collection of poems, Phil.
Well, thank you.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you about your poems. Again, the title of this collection of poetry is Core Samples, Poems by Philip Hemingway. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you for having me.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Revisiting a dead hawk. A picture of its eyes half closed tossed about endlessly in my mind last night, and a sick sweat poured from me. I could not forget, nor could I sleep. And so, the following morning, I left my room for a walk down the trail once more. I was in a hurry. I needed to pay my respects. This time I imagined a proper funeral procession and attempted in all my strength to avoid the enticing, delicate odors of flowers and of the earth along the way. There was too much life, and ironically, too much death in all of that. And a fleeting thought that hell would stick with us and not abandon came. It may have been the reports of looming war, or was that a dream of war in the streets? I felt confused and looked at the sky to gain my bearings. I picked up my pace again. When I had walked through all the curves and straight parts of this narrow trail and had passed the great eucalyptus at the top of the hill, the one with the faded sign at the base of it that read, Be Kind, I cast my eyes downward, reluctant to see what was now only 200 feet from me. My pulse began to race, and a fear gripped at my throat, and I wanted to run. I remembered last night, and my eyes searched for its large brown-black body ahead of me. There it was. A giant mass of enormous feathers lying on its back, its face looking upwards into a drab, smoky sky. There was no wind, and it was warm, the sun a dying orange. It was a kind of day that allowed hawks to climb great heights into the air. I hovered over the body like a bird, and with some courage, peered into its one still, half-opened eye. Its eye had a color I had no name for. A color indefinable and rarely, if ever, witnessed. An eye and its color, transmuted and rarefied by what it had felt and seen. And I'd seen it. It looked like freedom to me. Yes, it was the color of freedom. I won't forget. V.P. Bodrix.
To the critic who thought I should write more like Hemingway. I like a sentence that sends you roaring up Highway 1, driving a 1964 red Corvette, top down, on a bright summer day, rushing toward New York City. only to have you blow the engine just outside of D.C. Then throws you on a stinking Greyhound bus bound for the coast, with you in the very back seat where the rumble of the massive diesel engine creates a constant thunder in your ears, shakes your bones, and blots out the sounds of the couple making love under an old Navajo blanket in the seat just in front of you, somewhere between Denver and Cheyenne. David Fillauer.
American gypsies. There are no American gypsies living in trees, at least not yet. Only in canal zones, under freeways, in city parks. There are no colorful caravans. Only colorful tents, old trailers, worn-out cars, always told to move on. There is no one breaking into song for the joy or melancholy of it. Nobody dancing in the streets or breaking out the violin. No white-turbaned men. No women dressed in orange, pink, and gold. Just the downtrodden, fallen between the ever-widening cracks. The addicted and abused, the unlucky, those cracked under too much stress. Those without hope, those clinging to the last shred of it, the itinerant, the thieves, those just longing for a small patch of earth to call their own, for community. Many unable to help themselves do other than survive, hope beyond hope, for someone, anyone, to spare them a dime. Amy Gaffney.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
Listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.